You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, as migrants and refugees arrive in Austria and Germany to cheers and offers of food, has the tone of the commentary surrounding the crisis taken a complete U-turn? And will it last? I'll ask my studio guests Robert Fox and Mary Dajewski. And on a related topic, the US is set to revamp its efforts to create a rebel force in Syria. How effective can the mission be against the rising threat engulfing the nation? And what kind of international involvement should play a part? That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dajewski, columnist for The Guardian and The Independent here in the UK, and Robert Fox, defence editor for the London Evening Standard. Mary and Robert, welcome to you both. Just days ago, the international commentary surrounding what's been dubbed Europe's migrant crisis was dominated by politicians lining up to list why they can't do any more to assist the worsening problem. That tone has changed dramatically over the past few days, helped no doubt by the heart-wrenching image of three-year-old Aylin Kurdi face down in the sand in Turkey. People arriving in Austria and Germany this weekend were greeted not by protest or razor wire, but with cheers and offers of food. And in Finland, the Prime Minister offered his second home as accommodation for refugees. Even on the other side of the world, the Australian Prime Minister, known for his government's hardline stance on asylum seekers, struck a rare bipartisan chord by indicating the country would increase its humanitarian intake. Mary Dajewski, have you been surprised by this change of tone from political leaders over the past few days?
I haven't been surprised given the enormous impact of that single photo. I mean, in fact, there were two. There was one of the child actually on the sand face down, and then there was another of a volunteer picking him up. And those pictures had an enormous impact, at least, I would like to limit that slightly, among what you would call the people, to my mind, who were already convinced that something had to be done in the humanitarian dimension about all these people fleeing Syria. What I think is very early days is the way the politicians, starting with Merkel, Angela Merkel, in fact, put other leaders in a very difficult position because she basically opened Germany's door and said, everyone welcome. And as a political gesture, it was spectacular. It was fantastic for Germany's international reputation. It put other national leaders on the spot, including Cameron, who seems to have been unusually maladroit in his political response to this. But one of the reasons is that I think Cameron and maybe some other British politicians, and also in France, are looking a bit further down the line. And I'm sure that they are worried that when the immediate impact of those photos wears off, when the headlines are all about the cost, the difficulties of integration, the fact that people aren't learning English, then we may see that opinion flips just as decisively, just even more dangerously in the opposite direction.
Robert Fox, I mean, part of the reason why politicians had been so reticent to make a stand before was that there has been this rather poisonous atmosphere around the immigration debate for so long that separating the issue of refugees and asylum seekers seemed to be something that many of them found difficult to do.
Yes, well, the politicians and public both, but I want to go back on what Mary said, because curiously this is an old phenomenon that she and I grew up with called the CNN effect. And the CNN effect is a very well known rule in media and geopolitics. The CNN effect is when you see egregious scenes on a television screen, now through social media, and the cry goes up, something must be done, or it is perceived to go up by the politicians. Now, a colleague and friend, Nick Gowing, has written very learnedly about this, and it's extremely interesting what he concluded about the CNN effect, which really came into its being in the first CNN war, which is actually the 1991 Gulf War, and it was the flight of the Kurds when they created Haven, and there were unintended consequences, namely a Kurdish autonomy from that. The CNN effect only happens when there is a political vacuum or when there is indecision. And precisely what Mary has been describing, they are actually undecided. They just want this, particularly Cameron, they just want the darn thing to go away because it's another darned complication into a very complicated political issue. Very interesting. Can I just go on a little bit about the CNN effect? Of course, the man who spectacularly ignored it was Tony Blair. 5 million people marched in protest against the Iraq war. He didn't care a damn. He went to war. And this is where we're seeing a very volatile action-reaction between perceived public opinion and political action. I've written a column in today's this afternoon's Evening Standard. I don't usually plug my material, but I've said how short-term this is. They seem to be flying in the face of the very long-term phenomena, which are now well underway. By the way, I notice you didn't refer to Italy and Matteo Renzi and Greece. And Matteo Renzi and his predecessors have been seeing this movement growing actually for decades. I was writing about it 25, 30 years ago. And what I think is really worrying about this, park for a minute the Syrian conflict, is how superficial or non-existent the analysis is, either from big media or from big politics. The only one who seems to get near it from time to time are Angela Merkel, and there's a particular demographic problem in Germany, which we might get into, and possibly Barack Obama. But the British approach, which has been so spectacular, is absolutely fumbling in the dark.
Mary, is there also an issue here that, yes, you can have the CNN effect and that sort of shows something which hasn't been seen before, but there's also the argument that this photo was a tipping point and actually it crystallised what many people were thinking, but perhaps either weren't brave enough to step forward and say, or hadn't really thought through properly until they were confronted with this?
I think that's one way of looking at it. I'm not sure that it's the way that I look at it, because I think that there were polls in the British papers over the weekend that suggested that there'd been pretty much no change in attitudes towards asylum seekers and Syrian refugees after the publication of those photos. And I think that on the one hand, you know, I would agree with Robert to an extent about the CNN, that this is a media, something that's manufactured by the media. But the other side of it is that it's effectively silenced all the people on the other side, because suddenly it became sort of not quite right to suggest that over the long term, this number of people coming into European countries without any sort of controls, that this might be a problem. And all the people who thought that, which I think in Britain opinion has been, if we think that opinion has not really shifted, it's pretty much 50-50. It's very, very finely balanced. And so, you know, it could tip again.
Robert, you said, you know, many people are looking at this in a very short-term way. There's an argument, though, that, you know, if you can find a short-term solution right now, you should try to find it. I mean, David Cameron was mocked earlier when he said, well, the solution is peace in the Middle East. We can't just take people in. But actually taking people in right now, many people would argue, does really help.
Yes, it does. It helps them. And of course, it is a cry of humanity. And it's amazing how of the really intelligent, thoughtful conservative commentators in the United States have taken that line. But actually, what I'm very sorry for David Cameron, because what he is saying is not entirely daft. Because what nobody is saying, except our Fox in the Evening Standard, is this is over a third of the Syrian population that was there in that country 4.5, 5 years ago has gone. Most of that will not go back. Most of that is vanguard, highly intelligent people. And these people are not coming out of Syria now. I don't mean to criticize them. I don't blame them at all for what they're doing. But one of the things we're not talking about, and we're bowing and scraping too much to acronyms like UN, UNHCR, there is something very, very bad going on in those camps. And it has been noted and extremely well reported, may I say, by colleagues from the New York Times and the New York Press. They're suspects of corruption, of exploitation of minors, of sheer criminality, and of course they have been ISIS entry points, to the extent that last year when a huge camp was constructed in Jordan, nobody went there because of the experience in previous camps. The refugees coming from Syria deliberately headed for townships and villages. The fact that that regime, by that the regimen rather, of the camp seems to be collapsing, I think is extremely worrying indeed.
Mary, then is this an opportunity, when there is so much focus on this issue, for the politician that can grasp the nettle and say, actually, we need to sort out some of the broader issues now about how we're going to deal with those who, as Robert says, have fled Syria over the past four years or so now, who, you know, if we're not careful, aren't going to go back, and also then aren't going to be there to help rebuild that country.
Absolutely. And in a sense, I would say that actually we, even the best of the Europeans, even Angela Merkel, has come to this very, very late, because it was clear from quite an early stage that there was complete disarray from the first time that they tried to do something and mentioned quotas being distributed. They met, you know, it wasn't just the British who had an opt-out, but they met blanket refusal from Central Europe, who said, well, you know, we don't really have a tradition of harbouring Muslims, so we'd really like a few Christians, please. And this went down extremely badly in the EU and in NATO, where it was felt, you know, these so-called new Europeans were benefiting at quite some expense from sort of protection against the Russian flank in solidarity in Europe. And there was another side to the European values that everybody goes on about, and that includes some sort of solution to this refugee crisis, but it's extraordinarily difficult.
It's interesting looking at the way the European Union has responded, this union of 28 nations, Robert. It's felt sometimes, you know, when Italy has said, look, we need help, they really mean it. They need help. They can't cope with what they're doing. But when other countries have said, well, look, we need a solution that all 28 nations can agree with, you half get the feeling that they know full well there's never going to be any agreement that all 28 nations can agree with. And this is a way of looking like, well, look, we're trying to do something, but you know what it's like.
There's been some very intelligent comment just this morning about this. This is a huge problem, and no individual nation can do it, even with one in the lead like Germany, or, you know, when you're looking at it globally with the US, with the enormous amount of funding that it gives to the UN and its agencies. Only Europe can do it. But here is the paradox, which is where, sorry, the other shoe is going to drop, and I don't want to go on at length because we could devote the whole programme to it. What is also playing with this is the demographic crisis, which is what Angela Merkel understands. Europe is aging. It is the most aging continental population in the world. It's not replacing itself. The problem, as somebody like Merkel, who is a visionary, and Mrs. Thatcher understood this, by the way, realizes that they're not replacing themselves. By the way, natality, that is fatality, is lowest in the eastern, very eastern countries that you've just named. And that's the most tremendous paradox. But on the other hand, you cannot say we'll empty out the Middle East, we'll relieve the acute problem, which is now being faced by Lebanon, being faced by Jordan. And goodness knows what's going to happen when this really eats into the expanding crisis, not just Syria, not just ISIS, but Yemen and whatever's going on in the sub-Sahara affecting Libya, when it eats at the two big players, Turkey and Egypt. then you can't just say, bring them in. But by the way, a very quick one where there has been vehement criticism, and I think quite right, is the absolute inaction, closed doors, from the Gulf Arab countries, Saudi Arabia in the lead, whose comportment in this has been appalling.
No, I would agree with that absolutely. But I think that one of the things, given that Europe has now become not just for refugees from the Middle East, but for, you know, we saw revolution in Ukraine based on the desirability of the European model. And we may look at it from inside and say, you know, this is ridiculous, there's so many things wrong with it. But I think one of the things that is going to have to happen is that the European Union is going to have to establish either orderly migration or a refugee organisation, a formal refugee organisation with formal procedures for the whole Union. Because one of the other interesting sidelines on all this is that the European Union has pretty much been left to its own devices here. The international refugee organisations have concentrated on Lebanon and Jordan for obvious reasons. But I think people have looked across at Europe and said, well, you know, that's Europe's problem and they're a rich place and they can handle it.
But that's it. It's Europe might be rich, but it doesn't actually necessarily have the organisational capacity.
But there's also a legacy, which, I mean, sorry, this is deep history, but it is really, you do have to see it in the historical perspective. And this is the last play out of decolonialization. And there is a guilt factor there. And that's why you still get the blame factor going with Europe, principally Britain, France, Spain, and Portugal, and the Dutch to some extent.
Okay, we're going to have to move on, but just slightly, because without a doubt, many of those fleeing to Europe are escaping, as we described, the chaos gripping Syria. And there was a significant development in the UK's activities against ISIS fighters in Syria today. Here's what Prime Minister David Cameron had to say a little bit earlier in the House of Commons.
Now, Mr. Speaker, in recent weeks, it's been reported that two ISIL fighters of British nationality who had been plotting attacks against the UK and other countries have been killed in airstrikes. Both Junaid Hussein and Rayad Khan were British nationals based in Syria who were involved in actively recruiting ISIL sympathisers and seeking to orchestrate specific and barbaric attacks against the West, including directing a number of planned terrorist attacks right here in Britain, such as plots to attack high-profile public commemorations, including those taking place this summer. We should be under no illusion. Their intention was the murder of British citizens. So on this occasion, we ourselves took action.
That was Prime Minister David Cameron a little earlier today, revealing that an RAF drone attack had killed two ISIS fighters, both of whom were British. Mary Dujevsky, before we get on to the slightly sort of shaky legal issues here, the fact that the UK is already sort of taking and revealing the action that it's taken against ISIS in Syria now, as well as Iraq, suggests that the UK, like the US, is perhaps in this for the long haul.
Well, I think you can, I mean, that's one conclusion you can draw. I would think another one is the ambiguity of this whole situation, that you've got people in the UK who are born and bred in the UK or are second generation immigrants who are going off to fight for Islamic State in Syria or Iraq. And you've got the government sort of really maintaining a very strong rhetoric against them, and some of them in practice with these drone strikes. But then you've got this human sea coming the other direction. And I think that makes this much more complicated. I think it's also true, and I don't know whether there was, you know, it seems a little bit unfair to impute a degree of cynicism to the timing of Mr. Cameron's announcement, but they're introducing the subject of the drone strikes on British citizens fighting in Syria or Iraq. That it has it's a sort of balancing aspect which says, careful, Syria and ISIL, they're still a danger.
Robert Fox, there's the issue of the timing, why he's decided to reveal this now. And then there is the legal issue here about, you know, can the UK government essentially, well, kill two of its own citizens?
Well, when Cameron announced that British jets were going to join the Allied air campaign against ISIL, Daesh, in over Iraq, he reserved to himself the right to order strikes when British lives, as he put it, and British security, I mean, it's there on the record. I think, by the way, we throw concepts of legality too easily, because what is the law on this? Here we, in the UK...
Well, that's why I say it's shaky.
We're in the shadow. He can do what he likes. If he deems the country to be at war with ISIL and vital national interests are at stake, he could still invoke the royal prerogative because it is no. We still
have to do exactly what he likes. I mean, he couldn't. Could he kill a British citizen in Britain?
Well, you see, the interesting thing from my point of view is that so far there hasn't been a gigantic outcry about this, because I don't think our sense of national identity and sort of national privilege is as strong as it is in the United States. There have been examples, at least one, maybe more, where American citizens have been killed in drone strikes, and the outcry in America has been colossal. And I don't, because it's about the sort of sanctity of being an American citizen, and
which is enshrined
down. And I don't think that would. I think Cameron's fortunate. I don't think that same sense applies here.
But you're, Robert, you think that it's essentially he can do what he likes.
Technically, he can do what he likes. It is that the precedent changed with Tony Blair consulting Parliament before going to war. And from there, Cameron moved to say that he had to consult Parliament and get its approval.
I'm not talking about the fact of, you know, what action can a prime minister take in terms of what military action, but the very fact this was specifically targeting two British citizens seems to be somewhat unusual, doesn't it?
No, the IRA, in the campaign of the IRA, the SAS was slotting IRA British citizens left and right. I mean, it does happen.
They might not have said they were British citizens.
They were British passport carriers. I mean, even if they were Irish, they were entitled to carry a British passport, and they were operating in Northern Ireland.
I think a whole load of things can be done in the UK and outside the UK in the name of national security.
Which you couldn't
covers,
do in the States. I absolutely agree with you on that. Yeah.
Let's just turn now also to what the US is doing or trying to do. Robert, they have been at various stages over the past 3 or 4 years talking about helping to fund rebels and then maybe doing, and then maybe giving some arms, and then there'd be a training program. None of it, frankly, has worked. And now there's a story on the front of the New York Times today suggesting that they are trying once again to arm a set of rebels in Syria. You're shaking your head.
It's about the fourth time. It hasn't really worked. They had screening procedures for Division 30, as it was called. They had under 50 volunteers. Very sadly, they were taken out by Al-Qaeda because just before they went on operations, some of them went back home for Eid. They were identified. It is absolutely hopeless. There is no US allied proxy force available to fight that can really confront ISIS on the ground in Raqqa or in Iraq. The only ones that have shown themselves to of any consistent capability are the YDG, is it the youth cadres affiliated to the PKK? We know who dislikes the PKK, the Kurdish Workers' Party. But actually, Kobani, where the unfortunate boy came from, who was drowned in the Aegean. But Kobani, that's where the PKK affiliates showed they knew how to do air land operations. They knew how to coordinate on the ground with very small numbers and work with air attack. Nobody else has been able to work with the Allied Air Force in that way.
But Mary, going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, and this wave of refugees, many of them coming from Syria, they're coming because their country is a disaster and a war zone and a war that seemingly can't be won. And for Western leaders for those that actually want to do something and try to solve this crisis, How do they do this? Because as Robert's just pointed out there, any attempt to try and arm a rebel group that even we sort of remotely agree with their aims has ended in a colossal failure.
Well, you do sort of rather think that training and preparations and even arming people would actually be better, would be of greater use if it were designed to create safe havens that some people have been talking about. Now, I think that is questionable. The success of such planning, it would be very, very difficult to guarantee. It could make it even more difficult to come to any sort of temporary peace in Syria. But I think that, I mean, it just seems extraordinary in the context of everything that we've seen over the last few days, for Americans to talk about sort of upping the war rather than upping other angles, I think is really just seems out of place. I think that there's another little angle on that, maybe, that at the start of the week, there were some very strange reports. I mean, I didn't find them hugely convincing, that Russia was sending new weapons and planes to support Assad, that it was beefing up its very pathetic bases and was preparing to get more involved. I'm not sure how credible those reports were, but it may be that one aspect of the American reports was designed to parry that.
Robert, with all this focus then on this issue, do you think there is the possibility that there will be an attempt to try and find a more long-term solution?
Well, I think there are attempts all the time, I must say that, and I think Russia is absolutely crucial to it. And I share Mary's scepticism about these reports, but we had extravagant reports at the end of last week that actually Russian pilots were going in to fly Syrian Air Force planes. Now, Putin is no fool. He wouldn't get involved in that. He did see Assad as a vital ally. He now sees the thing as a real problem because ISIS, ISIL and its affiliates is an absolute menace to him. But there's something that has to be said, which hasn't been in the prints or in the broadcasts. This is a very complicated conflict, sui generis. It's very interesting listening to, on the BBC, they came across a very articulate group of English speakers, a wonderful English teacher from Homs. Homs is old city where a lot of it kicked off. It's an extremely complicated, impacted tribal clan mafia town. And this is what the problem with Syria is. Unless you have a military dictatorship, almost on an ancient Greek model, which is really what the Assads were, with kleptocracy thrown in, it's going to be very, very difficult to make a coherent country out of this. And as the kaleidoscope shatters, in the tribal and ethnic kaleidoscope shatters across that area of the Middle East, it is bound to affect, have a tremendous impact on both Lebanon and Jordan. And I'm very surprised we're not hearing more intelligent comment, which we normally do, from the Israeli press on this. Haaretz has been surprisingly bland about all of this.
Mary, just before we end, where do we go from here? Very briefly, you've got 30 seconds.
I think there has to be some pan-European initiative to develop a refugee agency and to regularise the way people can come to Europe. That's the first thing, both on humanitarian and for work. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I think maybe that not right now, but in the next few weeks, we will be starting to look at the Americans and the Russians and the Europeans all starting to talk to each other in a more formal way.
And the Iranians?
Maybe the Iranians and also the Turks. But, you know, the problem is that the moment you mention any single one of those, you have a new faction entering the equation. And the entry of the Turks into helping with the airstrikes, that introduced the Turkish Kurds and a whole new dimension.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Robert Fox, Mary Dzhevsky, thank you both very much indeed. Today's edition of Midori House was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Federico Romanelio. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Josh Fennett is here next, then it's Culture with Robert Bound. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, that is 1800 hours here in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.